Good evening, everyone. My name is Richard Cruz, and I'm co-chair of the Council on Palliative Care here in Montreal. This lecture is being sponsored by the Council, and just a couple of words about it, although I think most of you are aware of its activities. It was founded, I think, 16 years ago at the suggestion of Cappy Flanders, and at that time, there were two co-chairs, Mrs. Flanders and David Burke. The Council's activities the Council has a fairly clear mandate to promote end-of-life care within the McGill Hospital community and the medical community, to serve as an advocate for palliative care at the political level, and to provide educational activities for the community in its broadest sense, including healthcare professionals and people living in the community. And it has it is not a fundraising organization, it's a service organization. And I think it has been eminently successful. This is, of course, part of its educational mandate. It's worked closely with the annual meeting on the semi-annual meeting, International Conference on Palliative Care. A note about David Burke. David, as I indicated, was the initial co-chair of this council and had an abiding interest in this and other community activities. He was an architect. He was the Secretary General of McGill University, an important administrative position. I knew him then when we were both administrators in that organization. He has had an impact on numerous community organizations in the Montreal area. And he unfortunately passed away much too young following an accident. And since then, we felt that it was important that his contributions and his role be remembered. And we have always had a David Burke Memorial Lecture since that time. The format has varied because we do have many different educational activities, and this year it's being done, obviously, in collaboration with the International Congress. So we're thinking of David, and we welcome you all on this wonderful fall afternoon. We're very fortunate. This is a new type of activity. Dr. Kieran O'Boyle is going to give a talk entitled The ABCs of Stress Management. Dr. O'Boyle's contributions and organizations are so numerous that I'm going to do something which I don't like doing. There are so many of them that I couldn't memorize them all. But I'm going to give you a little bit about what he's done and the sort of the stage upon which he plays. He's a professor of psychology. He's head of the Institute of Leadership at the Royal College of Surgeons of Ireland, and that's an organization which sponsors leadership. I think he said 500 people enrolled in multiple countries in their program to promote leadership within the healthcare professions. From 2002 to 2006, he was vice dean of the Faculty of Medicine and Health Sciences with particular responsibility for strategy and quality assurance. He is the national educator for the Royal College, the RCSI Advanced Trauma and Life Support Program. That's Royal College of Surgeons of Ireland. He established the first department of psychology in an Irish medical school in 1985, and he's been a visiting professor at the School of Dental Science, Trinity College, Dublin. He was a senior research psychologist and psychopharmacologist at the Irish Foundation for Human Development. He holds a Bachelor of Science in Psychology and in Pharmacology and a PhD, both from the University College Dublin, and he has a diploma in theology from the Milltown Institute of Theology and Philosophy. The impact of psychology on teaching, on end-of-life care, and on clinical care, the potential of that is enormous, and I think we're just beginning to scratch it, and we're looking forward to this talk with a great deal of anticipation. I think we're going to hear something new. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dick, for that wonderful introduction. I'm a lot smaller, as you can see, than Dick, so I think I'll just stand here, because if I stand there, you won't see me. I'm honored to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation, and to be here to give a lecture in memory of David Burke. As Dick said, I'm a psychologist, but I've also spent a lot of my time in different kinds of organizations. So what I'm going to try to do is to, yes, I'm going to talk about stress, but I want to set that in a broader context. And the context is that of how do we actually see human beings? How should we see human beings in healthcare settings, in organizations, and just in general, how do we operate, or how do we function as human beings? So I'll say something about that. I'd like to say something about the fact that we're social beings, that we're all connected. We're all developing through our life cycle. I'll say something about that. And then I'll talk a little bit about stress and how we survive and how we cope. Now, I'm well aware that there are different interests in the audience. Some people are carers or have been carers. Some people work in the healthcare system. Others are maybe interested in the generic overview of stress. So I'll do my best to cover that ground. When I started working about 20 years ago on stress research, at the same time, I started working on the measurement of patient quality of life. And for many, many years before that, my hero was this man, Viktor Frankl, whom many of you will be familiar with. Sometimes you're asked, who's the person you'd most like to have met? And this is the person I would most like to have met. For those of you who don't know the story of Viktor Frankl, when he was a young psychiatrist in Vienna, 26 years of age, himself and his family were taken by the Nazis, and he ended up in Auschwitz concentration camp. And he survived. His wife, unfortunately, didn't. Neither did any of his family. And he wrote a book in 1949 called Man's Search for Meaning. And it still stands as the most important, for me, the most important single volume on what it is to be human. And sometimes those of us who work in these very complex environments with the advancement of knowledge, we need to go back to revisit milestones in civilization, milestones in knowledge. Essentially what Frankl said was that the basic nature of human beings is to create meaning. That no matter what our circumstances, we struggle to create meaning out of those circumstances. And if you think about this concept of patient quality of life, that's a very broad concept. It's been defined in numerous ways. But essentially my view on it is that patient quality of life is really about how patients create meaning when they're struggling with their situation. And that led me to think a bit about how we construct meaning. This is a very famous painting by Dali, and it's called The Slave Market with the Disappearing Bust of Voltaire. Now, you can see this image of Voltaire here, made up of two nuns. You see that? And the philosopher Voltaire, he was very critical of the Catholic Church. Or Dali, rather, was very critical, as was Voltaire. So this was a bit of an in-joke by Dali to create this image. But what's important about the image is that you can take the same set of stimuli and perceive them or understand them in two completely different ways. So what the mind does is it actually structures reality. And that becomes very interesting when you start to think about, you know, the complexity of human beings and how it is that we try to measure what's going on or try to understand what's going on when somebody is dealing with an illness. So the nature of human beings, I think it's important to think carefully about this. I think the first thing that I would say is, this is the theologian John Macari, who said, all men and women share a common humanity. And yet, although there are billions of them, Everyone has a certain uniqueness. Everyone has a unique perspective on the world and is responsible for a unique life. And the challenge for our hospital systems, for our education systems, our social services systems, is in some way to be able to provide high quality care or education or social services while still recognizing the uniqueness of each and every person that they're dealing with. So when we started to work on quality of life research, there were many different questionnaires around. You'd be given a quality of life questionnaire, which would ask you questions like, you know, can you walk 50 meters? You know, you tick yes, and somebody would have decided that that meant you get a score of 1 for being able to walk 50 meters. The fact that you might be a chess player and weren't very interested in walking 50 didn't really matter. And these questionnaires have become very fashionable. There's one very widely known called the SF36. It's used all over the place. It's a standard tick box exercise, and you know, you get scores. The problem is somebody else has decided what your scores mean, not you. So we were very uncomfortable with that, the idea that this wasn't, it's not my quality of life you're measuring, it's your idea of my quality of life that you're measuring. So we went to do something completely different. And we decided that we'd develop an individualized measure of quality of life and see could we make that scientific, something that we could get numbers out of. So we went back to some early research from Boulder in Colorado on judgment analysis. How do people make judgments? And we developed a measure over 2 years called the SEQUAL, the Schedule for Evaluation of Individual Quality of Life. And I'd like to just tell you a little bit about that. We had that developed, and I gave a talk in 1992 at the Association of Surgeons of Great Britain and Ireland and on the SEQUAL. And the following week, I got a call from the editor of The Lancet to know would we send her a paper on the SEQUAL. It's fairly rare for The Lancet to ring people up and ask her for papers. So we did. We sent them the paper, and they published it. And the reason they were interested in it was this was a whole new way of thinking about patient quality of life. We're very unpopular with the questionnaire folk. You know, they don't really like this approach. So here's what we do with this. We say to people, what are the most important areas in your life, the 5 most important areas? People think about that and they give us the areas, and it can be anything. It's the person's choice. It can be anything. And then we say, well, really, how are you doing on each of those areas? So they rate that on a scale, you know, good, very badly, very well. We then try to find out what's the relative importance or what weight would people put on each of these areas. Because clearly if you're doing well in an area that's unimportant, you know, that's not that serious. But if you're doing very badly in an area that's very important for you, that's much more serious. And we developed a very complicated system of developing the weights by asking people to make a whole set of judgments. And then you see, if you know what the weights are and what the levels are, you can do some maths with that and get a single score. Now, I don't have time to go into it in detail, but what I'll do is just give you a sense of how that works. Have we a problem? Can you hear me okay? Yeah, we're okay. All right. So here's an example of the printout from this kind of measure. Here's a patient who was terminally ill with cancer, and she nominated family, finance, health, religion, and company, having friends, as being her 5 most important areas. The yellow bars show you the blue bars show you how she's doing in each of these, so this isn't going very well. She feels health is fine, even though she's terminally ill. Religion is going particularly well. Company is going fine. And the weights here give you some sense of what's important. So family is very important. These are relative weights, but it's going badly. Finance is fairly important, going badly. And these areas that are going well, she doesn't really see them as being all that important. So if we multiply these one by the other and sum, she gets an overall score of 53, which gives us a rough idea of how she sees her quality of life. And when we're doing this measure, we build in 10 repeat cases so we can tell how reliably she's doing this. Here, for contrast, is another patient, again, terminally ill, and you can see that, you know, hope for remission is important, life satisfaction, family, her husband and her friends. And because she's doing very well in these areas that are important, you can see that her overall quality of life is much higher. And patients just love this because it allows them voice. It allows the person to say, what's important to me? How am I doing? And what's the relative importance of this? Just let me go back there one, because I think I skipped over something. I'm glad to say the SQL is being used now in about 300 centres worldwide for all kinds of applications, because it doesn't need translation. This is a project that Kate Senior, who's an anthropologist in Darwin, is doing, which we're helping with, where the elders from the Aboriginal tribes are taking young males who are addicted to alcohol and drugs into training programs back out in the bush and retraining them in the ways of the elders. 2-week retraining programs. And they asked us to put this measure in to see could we show a significant improvement in their quality of life that they would generate more government funding. And we've been able to do that. So this is the SQL being used in the bush. And I'll come back to the SQL and say one or two more things about it as we go along. Oh, this is the stress part of the evening. If you'll just bear with me. The secret I've found over the years of counselling people on stress is to worry about the things that you can control and not pay too much attention to those that you can't. Okay, so that's just by way of some background. So we've said that human beings are unique, they're individual, and we operate as human beings by creating meaning, by trying to structure our meaning. The second thing that I think is important to say about human beings is that we are fundamentally social creatures. This is my favorite play from my favorite playwright, but it took me a long time to understand it, Waiting for Godot. On a Tondon Godot, I think it's the original title. And you know the story. It's two tramps, Latimer and Estragon. Nothing much happens twice. And Beckett never explained the play, except once. He said two things about it. He said, it's not the content that's important, it's the shape. Because you have two acts. Lucky and Pozzo come in from one side in the first act, they come in from the other side in the second act. So they're slightly asymmetrical. And he was asked by a journalist in the back of a car once in Paris, what is this about, Sam? And he said, symbiosis. And that is that our existential situation is such that it's difficult. Our existential situation is difficult. And the way we get through it is true relationships with others. So Latimer and Estragon, the two characters, it's relationship that gets them through their situation. And one way of seeing Godot, one way of seeing the act is that these are actually two sides of the one person, two sides of the alter ego. So what Beckett was interested in that early stage of his life, 1949, was how does that work to help us through the existential angst. And then in Endgame, he takes these two characters and picks them up again. Now, the problem with engaging with others is that, like anything else, our construction of them, our image of them, is not them. It's just our image of them. So one of the most difficult things, I think, to do is to actually stand in another person's position. We talk about that as if it's a fairly easy thing to do. I think it's an incredibly difficult thing to do. And essentially, in any caring relationship, that's pretty much what's being asked of us, to step in to the other person's position. Now, some of you will be familiar with this. We use this in training and communications all the time. It's called the Johari window. Is this familiar to some people? Well, let me explain. The reason it's called the Johari window is that it was described first by two psychiatrists, one of whose first name was Joe, and the other was called Harry, so they called it the Johari window, right? And here's the basic idea. Think about when you're communicating with somebody. There are things that you know about yourself, that I know about myself, and things I don't know about myself. There are things that others know about me, and things others don't know about me. So we have four kinds of things. And if you picture it like a window, when you're communicating with somebody, you're looking out through these four panes of glass, and they're also looking out through their four, so it gets fairly complicated. So here are things that I know about myself that other people also know about me. We call that the arena. Arenas are open places where we can see everything. And clearly it depends on the relationship, because for some people, your arena will be huge. They'll know a great deal about you. And for others, you want to keep that arena fairly small. This area here, we call it private. These are things I know about myself, but I don't want other people to know. And you can see in hospitals, for example, that line is very important. We don't like confidential information leaking into this area. There are things I don't know about myself that others do know about me. We call that the blind spot. Now, I'm showing that as these are all equal side, but some people have a blind spot that's that big. You know? Some people have a very small blind spot. But at least it sensitizes to the fact that when we're dealing with others, there are things that going on in their minds, in their heads, that we know nothing about. And then there are things that us that we don't. And then there's this area, the unknown. And when I say to students on master's classes, what's in there? Of course, the smart guys say, well, we don't know, sir. But there are things in there. There are unconscious processes, things from our childhood and so on, that are affecting or influencing communication. So one of the ways we can think about this is in terms of personal development. It's a good idea to try to minimize the blind spot. Now, how do you do that? You ask people. But who do you ask? You ask people that you've built up trust with by perhaps revealing some of the vulnerabilities that you have here. So I'm just showing you the Johari window as an example of one of those techniques that we can use to frame the complexity of human interactions. And I'll show how this applies in healthcare. This is a patient we saw many years ago. Dipna Waldron was working with me on this project. She was a lady, 52-year-old. She was married. Her husband was alive and well. Two adopted children. She was diagnosed with squamous cell carcinoma of the middle third of the esophagus. No secondaries at this stage. Radiotherapy and so on. So she was admitted to the hospice for respite care. She had a nasogastric tube in, and she was awaiting insertion of a PEG. That's for nutrition. And her family, there was a family meeting on the morning of her assessment. So we were working on quality of life in these inpatients at this stage. And we asked the nurse to do the full sequel for this patient. And the nurse's view was the important things for her quality of life would be swallowing, her energy, her family, communication with her family, and communication with her partner. And this was the nurse's estimate of how she was doing, and she felt she was doing very badly because this was very important to the patient, and it was going badly. And the nurse estimated her quality of life at 32, very poor. We asked her physician, who was treating her, to assess her quality of life. And you see it's a pretty grim picture here all over. This is the doctor's judgment of her quality of life, and that came out at 16. And then we asked Bridget herself, and she said, well, actually, it's great. She said, because my family is going very well, and it's very important, and the rest of it doesn't really matter all that much to me anyway. Right? And it's great. So this raises this whole issue about how do we communicate in healthcare across this gap, this bridge between our professional orientation towards a patient and their reality. We asked the nurse and the doctor and the patient all independently to rate symptom bother. How bothersome are your symptoms? So the nurse said, here are the symptoms. There are things like anxiety, weakness, chestiness, anger, and difficulty swallowing is a big deal. And the doctor said, anxiety, weakness, fear, dysphagia, difficulty eating and vomiting. And the patient said, well, actually, none of that stuff's very important to me. It's this nuisance of this nasogastric tube is the real problem that I have, the bothersomeness of it. So we're seeing this very discordant set of communication here. So we said, look, overall, could you say, we said to the nurse, if you tried to do a general assessment of how bothersome are her symptoms in terms of her quality of life, how big an impact is it having? And the nurse said, I'd say it's about 62%, roughly. So that's a big lump of her quality of life is being influenced by her symptoms. And we asked her physician, and he said, oh, it's worse than, it's 72%. It's a real big thing. And then Bridget said, well, actually, my quality of life's pretty good, you know, and my symptoms aren't really all that important. And the difference is that she's not seeing her situation through the medical or the nursing lens. She's seeing it through the lens of her living this life.
Now, you can't blame the nurse for having that perspective or the doctor for having that perspective. That's the way they're trained. That's the lens they're using. So you can see how using something like this measure helps to improve communication, because now it can be agreed between them what the issues are. Now, you will remember this case, Terry Schiavo. This was a very tragic case. This was a young woman who collapsed at home of oxygen starvation in 1990, aged 26. The hospital was sued in 1992. Her husband won the lawsuit, malpractice suit. In 2002 and 2003, the feeding tube was removed. The Florida emergency bill was passed in 2003. In March 2005, the feeding tube was removed again, and she died in 2005, aged 41. Can you remember what the issue was? There was a conflict between her husband and her parents. And basically, you had two proxies, proxy decision makers making judgments here, and they saw the situation really differently. And that went to court. Very tragic, very difficult set of circumstances, quite common, where relatives will have a different point of view. So we thought we'd ask the question, can I just go back from that for a moment? We thought we'd ask the question, how good are people at making proxy judgments of each other's quality of life? So who would you expect to be good at this? Well, we said, what about if you took people who'd been married to each other for at least 40 years? They should be pretty good at this. Now, Ireland was a Catholic country at that time, so you were able to get people who'd been married to each other for 40 years. A little bit more difficult now as we go along. So we went out and we found participants aged over 65, married at least 5 years. I'll tell you the means in a moment. One group was healthy. They had no chronic condition that impaired their function. And another group had an ongoing chronic condition. We had three groups where both were healthy, both were chronically ill, or one was ill and the other was well. And we did a kind of very interesting thing. We asked each spouse to separately say, what's important to me? How am I doing in each of these areas? And what are the weights? And then we said to the other spouse, this is what your wife has said is important to her. Would you rate the weight that she would put on that and how she feels she's doing on it? So husbands rated wives and wives rated husbands in these three conditions, both well, both ill. And the question was, how accurate would they be about judging each other's quality of life, doing it separately? And that's just the model here. I won't go through all of that. And basically, these are the data, but I'll explain to you what we found. Where the wife was the proxy, where she was rating her husband, it didn't really matter what the conditions were. She was pretty accurate. She was pretty accurate. Now, gentlemen, where he was rating her quality of life, he significantly underestimated her quality of life when he was well and she was chronically ill, and he also significantly underestimated when both were well. He got it right if he was chronically ill as well. Now, it's not a very strong finding, but it raises some of these questions about the reliance that we place on people who've known. The average length of time, by the way, these couples were married to each other was 40 years. These were people who had been together for 40 years. So it raises some very interesting questions and allows us a way of starting to look at that. So what I'm saying is that we're unique. We construct reality. We construct meaning. Quality of life is something very personal to individuals. And I think when we start to look at it, we have to be careful that it's the person's model that we're looking at, not somebody else's. The third thing I want to say about human nature is that we are, as Frankl said, we're about meaning, we're also about development. This is a wonderful quotation from Rainer Maria Rilke, the great German poet, in Letters to a Young Poet. And he put it like this. He said, "We live a strange book wherein we advance line by line without having the right to read the next page before the wind has turned it. But we possess the privilege of returning to a passage we have read before and seeing it reappear before our eyes. And we do this especially when the wind has risen and a leaf has trembled under our fingers." And as you probably know, Rilke wrote letters to a young poet, an 18-year-old poet, when he was 26 himself. So this is we're involved in this continuous process of development. Jung said that the driving force, so far as it's possible for us to grasp, it seems to be, in essence, only the urge to self-actualization. There's a force within us that develops us as we move along. Jung also said that after the age of 35, all problems are religious. Now, he didn't mean religious. What he actually meant was that we all struggle in one way or another with meaning. What am I here for? Why am I here? Am I living life the right way? Those kinds of questions are the key questions that click in. He said that before 35, we're concerned with career, family, those kinds of things. But this transition takes place where, rather than just being concerned with things external to ourselves, inner voices become more important. And I think most of us know that. That you start listening to inner voices, and something in that is metaphysical or transcendent. So what I'm saying is that in order for us to understand somebody with an illness, we have to be aware that this river is flowing, that development is taking place. The philosopher Heraclitus says we can't step into the same river twice. Both we and the river are changed. And we see this clinically. This is a patient. We did a study on ALS, which is motor neuron disease, horrendous condition. And we looked at the function. This is a single patient where we're looking at a functional rating scale. And here's a very significant deterioration in this person's functioning over 6 months. And here's their quality of life scale, individual quality of life scale for the same period. And it increases. So it's developmental because the person is adapting. The condition. They're not passive. They're not just simply passive. They're adapting and adjusting, and that's what human beings do. So I've gone through some of that in the first part of this to sort of bracket stress and stress management in this broader context of the nature of human beings. And I hope I'm making that clear that I see this as a much broader issue than, you know, just learning stress management techniques. So let's drill down a little bit and focus on this business of stress. When psychologists talk about stress, we have a very specific meaning in mind. We talk about something it's something that arises when there's a mismatch between perceived demands and perceived ability to cope. Now, what do you think is the most important word in that? It's perceived, yeah. It's not the demands, it's our perception of the demands and our perception of our coping ability that's important. So this is probably a good way to think about it. You all have demands acting on you. You have a certain perception of those demands. How important are they? How serious are they? What are the consequences? How urgent are they? And so on. That's one side of the balance. The other side of the balance is you have a capacity to cope based on your experience, your personality, your training, or whatever it is, and you have a certain judgment of that. If those two things are balanced, there's no stress. Is that fair? Stress really arises when the thing gets well out of balance. So say the demands significantly increase, and that's how I see it, and they significantly exceed my ability to cope. Now I'm in this stress arena. A certain amount of that, as you can see, would be just challenged, wouldn't it? That would be a positive thing. So pressure's not the problem. It's when the pressure, the coping, our perceived coping, exceeds significantly, or our demands exceed significantly our ability to cope. That's where we get into difficulties. Now, it could go the other way as well. You could see somebody who had a vast amount of coping ability, talent, and so on, where the demands were inadequate. And they don't burn out, they rust out, because it's boring, right? So I'd like you to kind of bear this in mind when we're talking about this. It's very much a construct. As Frankl said, we construct meaning. We also construct stress, our views of stress. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, and I think this is very important, is pressure's not bad for us. This is a rough sort of a notional diagram, but there's plenty of research behind it, looking at the relationship between pressure increasing here and performance on any task you like. A surgeon operating in an operating theater, somebody driving their car, giving a presentation, whatever. If there's no pressure, we have a state called boredom, and you can see the performance isn't very good here. This is the comfort zone where, you know, the performance is okay but could be better. The stretch zone is where, you know, the performance increases and we're being challenged, but we're actually up to the task. And then, of course, we reach this point where the performance starts to deteriorate. And I call this the strain area. And then this is panic. And what do you do when you panic? Your performance just drops. I spent about 10 years of my life as a consultant to the airline industry, selecting pilots. And we look for pilots who are kind of down around here. We don't really want pilots up here. You don't really want your pilot when the port engine goes on fire and you want to crash. You just want them to be fairly, and they are. They're kind of selected for their ability to handle anxiety. And then they're trained for that. Although the pilots now say that because aircraft are largely flown by computers, the perfect cockpit team is a pilot and a large dog. The pilot's job is to feed the dog. The dog's job is to bite the pilot if he or she touches any of the switches on the computer. Right? So the key point here that I'm making is that up to this point here, you can see that pressure is actually good for you. Pressure's okay. Pressure's fine. But when pressure exceeds our own individual ability to cope, that's when we get into this stress arena. And that point is different for all of us. And it's even different at different times. Sometimes you can take on the world. Other times you're wiped out by something fairly small or inconsequential. So being able to distinguish between pressure and stress is very important, because a lot of what people think is stress is actually pressure. Okay, let me come back to our patients again. This is a study we did looking at carer burden. And there's an awful lot on here. Don't worry about the detail. I'll just pick out one or two things. We were measuring, we were looking at carers' level of burden, and there were two groups. A high burden group where their quality of life was significantly lower than this group. So here's two groups of carers. We're looking at their quality of life. One group, their quality of life is poor. The other group, the quality of life is quite good. And you can see that the biggest problem is behavioral disturbance in their husband or wife or father or mother. It's the behavioral disturbances and the rest of it. This is what the pharmaceutical industry focuses on, memory loss and all of that. But here's where the real problem is for the carer burden. So you can use a stress model to look at this kind of stress. So how do we respond emotionally, psychologically, behaviorally, and our bodies respond to stress or pressure? In caring, whether it's professional caring or family caring, there are two tolls of caring. One is called burnout, and the other is called compassion fatigue. I'm not going to dwell on these, but to give you some idea, I think this is a great example of an image of burnout. Frutenberger described this, and he said, where once there was a vital structure, a living structure, there only remains the crumbling reminders of energy, leaving a sense of desolation. It's a great description of burnout. And compassion fatigue is a bit like post-traumatic stress disorder, where over long periods of time caring, it can happen that a person becomes traumatized. They see so much suffering in a loved one or in patients that they get arousal symptoms and re-experiencing and avoidance symptoms and so on. And there are various ways of addressing that. Okay. So we've looked at stress and said that it's this complex relationship between how we see the demands on us and our ability to cope. People are different. Pressure is okay. It's when it exceeds our ability to cope that we get into difficulties. Now what I'd like to turn to finally, in the final part of this, is just to say something about what are the big approaches that we can use to managing pressure and stress. So the first thing to say is just to reiterate our core human characteristics, and again I want to locate this in that context. So we're each of us unique. We construct the world. We develop throughout our life cycle. We have a need for actualization, and we're socially embedded. So when we teach coping strategies on various programs we do, these are the kinds of things we teach people, the kinds of skills. Assertiveness, assertive communication, being able to communicate assertively, balancing your empathy for the other person with your capacity to assert your own wants or your own views. Social support, building networks of social support, people with whom you can share the burden. Managing yourself, managing your thinking, taking time out, hobbies and leisure, looking after yourself, And then reducing maladaptive strategies, like alcohol, drugs, procrastination, and these kinds of things. This is a very useful idea from Stephen Covey's book, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, but it's been said by lots of people. And I think most of us come to this understanding ourselves anyway. The basic idea is that you can be concerned about lots and lots of different things, all kinds of worries and problems and concerns, but you only have influence or control over some of them. So there will be certain things out here in the hub that are concerns for you over which you have no control. There's nothing you can do about them. And there'll be other things here at the center that are concerns or worries for you that you have some degree of control over, that you can actually do something about. Proactive people focus here. Reactive people tend to focus out here. So in terms of changing thinking, the capacity to be able to decide what are the things that I have some measure of control over that I'm going to focus on and the things I have no measure of control over that I'm going to just not get involved with is an extremely important thing. You hear people all the time being stressed out about things that if they analyze it, they've essentially no control over. Their boss's personality, for example, you know. Or, you know, problems that they... A great example of problems with in-laws. I teach a lot in the Middle East, and in-law stories are a big deal in the Middle East. Somebody said to me recently, you know, behind every successful man is a surprised mother-in-law. But you get the idea here that, you know, it's stress management is not just about changing things out there in the environment, solving problems all the time. Sometimes it's about changing the way we think about problems, or at least distinguishing between those over which we have some measure of control and those we don't. And many of us get to that point, I think, just by living life. In the conference at the moment, there's a great deal of interest in the Buddhist notions around mindfulness. You know, the idea of learning to become aware of our thinking. You know, but thoughts are discontinuous. Thoughts aren't facts. Reacting versus responding to events, letting come and letting go, you know, and so on. I'm not going to get into this in a lot of detail. I've just come from a Buddhist and medicine conference in France where Sogyal Rinpoche, who wrote the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, was the main lama, and John Kabat-Zinn, who wrote Full Catastrophe Living, was the main Western lama. And what Rinpoche is saying is it's not about the Buddhist spirituality. That's not what it's about. It's about the Buddhist psychology. The Buddhists actually worked up some very interesting psychology of how the mind works. And a lot of this is about becoming aware of that. Now, in Christian mysticism, in the Judaic tradition, in Sufism, very similar sorts of ideas are to be found about learning to manage the mind. So that's becoming more important in stress management. This is probably the most important thing I've ever learned about stress management for myself. It comes from Stephen Covey, and some of you will be familiar with this. Covey says if you think about the things that you spend your time on, there are two variables. The first is how urgent are they, and the second is how important are they. Now, urgency, if you think about it, is determined by deadlines. You're up against a deadline. It's urgent. It has to happen immediately. Most of the modern technology we have, phones, email, and all that kind of stuff, is predicated on urgency. People ring you up to know that you get the email they sent you 5 minutes ago. Things are urgent, right? And if you think about it, importance is a different thing. Importance means what are the consequences of something having an effect if we do it or if we don't do it. Now, Covey says we confuse those two things. His question he often asks is, have you ever been too busy driving to get gas? Sometimes we wait until it's very, 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 very urgent, and then we do it. And modern civilization is based on urgency. Now, if you break those out, you've got four different kinds of things, four quadrants. Here are things that are urgent and important. You have to do those. You're up against it. It's a stressful box to be in. But there's lots of things that are urgent, but they're not important. Just think of email. I mean, the amount of stuff on email that's urgent but not important is huge. So a lot of time disappears here. So people spend a great deal of time in these two quadrants, and then they escape over here where they do stuff that's not urgent or important, like surf the internet or spend lots of time drinking coffee or something like that. Now, Covey says if you look at it, successful people, and by that he means people who are successful in relationships, in understanding themselves, in, you know, building career and so on, one of the characteristics of successful people is they spend time in this quadrant two. They do things that are important but not urgent. At least some of their time goes there. The first time I came across this was about 15 years ago, and I was spending all my time here. I would say I'm now about 50, 60% of my time is in quadrant two. It means not getting hooked into this stuff, but thinking about things that actually make a difference and being focused. Covey has a great way of teaching this. They put a large glass container, and they fill it full of rocks, which represent the important things. And he says, is this full? And people say, well, no. So they put gravel in, you know, and the gravel goes down between the rocks. And then they put sand in, and the sand goes down between the gravel and the rocks. The last thing to go in is water, yeah. Although there's an Irish version where the last thing is beer. So he says, now it's full. What does it mean? And somebody usually says it means you can really put a lot in. You get a lot into it. You can really fit a lot into a busy day if you try. You know? He says, no. The rocks are the most important things in your life, in your work. And if you don't put those in first, they won't fit. Because all that unimportant stuff will take all the time and the energy. So what becomes important here is thinking about, well, what are the important things? Family, life, social, and all of that. Spirituality, perhaps. And you put those in first and let all the other stuff rotate around them. I think that's a really useful way of thinking about time in terms of managing stress. There's a few more of these to go, and we draw to the end. There's a lot of very good research that shows that a key way of handling stress is building support networks. Generally speaking, women are better at this than our men. Yeah? There's three types of support. Instrumental support is people doing something for you. Informational support is when you share information. And emotional support is when people show empathy and feel for you. And we know lots of research to show that in high-stress situations, the people who are surrounded by support structures don't succumb so easily to depression and to various other illnesses associated with stress. Okay. The other thing I think is important is... I think some of us carry a great load of baggage with us throughout our lives, you know. Have you ever heard yourself talking to your kids and you sound exactly like your mother or your father, yeah? Or catch yourself in the mirror, yeah? Sometimes we just got to let some of that go, you know. Where do we pick up that? Well, I think we pick it up very early. You know, I've met people in the hospital who are living out, you know, a parental view of what they should be, even as in late adulthood. They still have the voice in their heads, their mother and the father telling them what they should do. Medical students are notorious for this, you know, they're very high achievers, and then they become very high achieving professionals, and then they have to keep on achieving because they've been grounded into this, I must achieve, I must always do better, I must never fail at anything. It's a pretty tough position to be in because life has a way of teaching you that you're going to fail at some point. And then I think managing lifestyle, and we could spend a lot of time on this exercise and diet. Planning ahead is very important, actually, you know, preventing problems before they arise. Okay, yeah, I'll just go back to that for a minute. Yeah, I think he looks a bit smug there. Okay, the final two or three points I want to make is there's a new movement has emerged in the science of psychology that's really very important. Martin Seligman in the University of Pennsylvania is really the pioneer of this. Basically, Seligman has said that we know since the Second World War, the Veterans Act and so on, psychology became very concerned with the downside, depression, stress and anxiety. We know a great deal about that. But we know very little about the positive sides of human nature. Hope, gratitude, love, satisfaction, these kinds of things. So emerging very strongly is a new way of thinking. And in this new way of thinking, one of the important things we can do is identify our strengths, our signature strengths, as Seligman calls them. A lot of good research going on this now. And here's an example of some of the signature strengths: emotional intelligence, courage, kindness, perseverance, and so on. So in trying to help people come to terms with problems, sometimes what we can do is actually not deal directly with the problems, but actually look to see where the strengths the individual has. What are the strengths the individual have? This is the website in UPenn, and you can go on there. It's www.authentichappiness.ass@upenn, and you can assess your signature strengths to your heart's content. And it's a pretty good place. It's good. They're doing good science. I don't know why this is changing. I mean, I think there's some timers in here. So that's a whole kind of new movement where we're starting to learn a great deal more about the positive side of human nature. So coming to a close then, let me give you a conversation stopper for dinner parties. If somebody asks you, you know, what is the nature of a human being? Just tell them this and say a psychologist told you that human beings are unique, active, complex, socially embedded, and developmentally dynamic self-organizing systems. But that does summarize, I think, what I think. We are unique. We are active. We make sense of the world. We're complex. We are socially embedded. We rely on others. We're developmentally dynamic. We develop throughout our life cycle. And we're self-organizing, right? And we're engaged in a lifelong quest to achieve meaning by maintaining a delicate balance between ordering and disordering processes. Disordering processes, the negatives in life, are very important because that's how we learn to create order. Yeah. And if you want to think about somebody who I think embodies this, I think Mandela, who's an honorary fellow of the RCSI, he accepted an honorary fellowship from us about 4 or 5 years ago. A very interesting example of that, I think you'd agree. Okay. So, broadening it out a little bit and coming to an end, I really like this quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson, particularly in these materialistic times. He says that the definition of success, to laugh often and much, to win the respect of intelligent people and the affection of children, to earn the appreciation of honest critics, and to endure the betrayal of false friends, to appreciate beauty, to find the best in others, to leave the world a bit better, whether by a healthy child, a garden patch, or a redeemed social condition. To know that even one life has breathed easier because you have lived. This is to have succeeded. I think that's a wonderful, talismanic way of thinking about success for our times. We'll come back to that. So let me just summarize then what I've said. Stress is complex, but doesn't need to be unnecessarily complex. I think there are a whole variety of approaches to coping with stress or pressure. It depends on the person and it depends on the situation. The big things to think about is how we think about problems, how we manage our time, how we build social networks, support structures around us, and then I think broadly how we look after ourselves and the kind of philosophy that we develop around ourselves. I want to leave you, for my part, because we'll have some questions, I think. I want to leave you with a final thought. Some of you may know this, but some of you may be new to you. We had in Ireland a wonderful philosopher, Christian sage, called John O'Donoghue. He was a priest who was a philosopher who was a writer, and he died last year at the young age of 52. And he wrote a number of books about Celtic spirituality that have had a huge impact, not just in Ireland, but outside of Ireland. And this is a blessing that John O'Donoghue wrote for his mother, who was ill. But it's a blessing that it's words I'd like to give to you, to leave to you. You can't come from Ireland and not bring a poem with you. So I wanted to finish my words and my thoughts with this poem by John O'Donoghue, and it's called Bannocked or Blessing. On the day when the weight deadens on your shoulders and you stumble, may the clay dance to balance you. And when your eyes freeze behind the grey window and the ghost of loss gets into you, may a flock of colours, indigo, red, green, and azure blue, come to awaken in you a meadow of delight. When the canvas frays in the curragh as a boat of thought, and a stain of ocean blackens beneath you, may there come across the waters a path of yellow moonlight to bring you safely home. May the nourishment of the earth be yours. May the clarity of the light be yours. May the fluency of the ocean be yours. May the protection of the ancestors be yours. And so may a slow wind work these words of love around you, an invisible cloak to mind your life. Thank you very much. Thanks.
Well, that was quite wonderful. We're now going to have a question and answer period and a sort of a panel discussion. In order to sort of offer social commentary from a local perspective, we've asked Zelda Freitas, who works at a CLSC and has been very active with the Council of Palliative Care, and Laura Boroditsky, who's been a caregiver and also active in the council, to come and sit on the podium, on the chairs, with our guest speaker and open up the discussion. And I'll be the referee. Comments, questions? Do you believe all that? Do the panel want to start off with some comments? Any way of turning off that spotlight? Shoot.
Let's shoot.
I'm sorry, could I ask that they use the microphone? Because this is, if they don't use the microphones, it doesn't work on the internet.
Okay, great. And maybe identify yourself, name, number, serial number, all that kind of stuff.
Experience of that when we started using the CEQAL, the measure that I talked about, was that because it was patient centered, it was patients talking about their own situation, but in a way that provided a framework for that. It was often very surprising what emerged from that, that people's quality of life as they experienced it was much better than it would have looked from the outside. And often what happens is that patients adapt. You know, sometimes a patient will say, I wouldn't want to live if it was like this. But when it gets like that, adaptation has taken place, and I want to continue on. I think there's a real challenge with DNRs, particularly here, I think, in this part of the world, where, you know, DNRs are assigned, and it gets to be a very complicated sort of negotiation then. I think that's where really, really good communication is necessary. The problem is, and we heard about this today at the conference, the problem is that when communication is going on, the healthcare team, you know, there's their involvement, there's the patient and family involvement, and then there's the overall context in which it's happening. And all three need to be balanced. But first and foremost would be the views of the individual patient. But we need better ways of communicating that. We need better ways of sharing the information. That's my view on it. And a number of doctors who use the SeqWell, both GPs and hospital specialists, have said to me that it has changed the way they make decisions. It has changed their views on things because they have this shared way of speaking about issues.
Specifically at the Royal Vic, and you know, intensive care is pushed all the time, pushing the patients, pushing, you know, the family to basically sign the non-resuscitate, and it's not comforting in any way. I know they want to clear the beds in a way, because that's what has been expressed, is this clearing of the beds, and I understand, but quality of life and somebody wanting to live, I mean, there's a lot of people out there that are committing suicide because they want to die. So why are we there to stop them? And then you have a patient that is, let's say, 80 years old, but still wants to live, even at that bed.
Yeah.
And the way they're dealing with their pains, they're dealing with all that. I had another situation with a friend of mine many years ago. She had MS. And, you know, we went through the whole thing, and she got sicker, and then she was telling me, if I get in a wheelchair, forget it, I want to die, and, you know, I'm going to leave you in charge. And then she got in the wheelchair, she didn't want to die.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, she's like, if I get into diapers, I want to die. And we got into the diapers. And then we got to the point where she was literally paralyzed from the neck down. And I would sit next to her, and she'd be yelling profanities at me, give me a cigarette, I don't want to die. And I was like, how is this possible? You were telling me when you were mobile, you know, either in a cane, you got in the wheelchair, then the diapers, and now you're completely paralyzed from the neck down. If I was you, I would want to die. She didn't want to die.
Yeah.
Laura or Zelda, got comments?
Yeah, I think this goes back to your point of transitions and how people adapt as they go along. So what you might want today, as you adapt to what's going on and you cope with the situation, you may change your mind like your friend did as she went along. She was able to cope with that different level of her illness as it came along because she hadn't experienced it before. So as she was coming through the experience, she adapted to it. So that was her perception. But I want to get back to your 80-year-old mom or friend.
My mom's passed away, but right now we have another.
Yeah.
She really wants to live. And I mean, I go in, and once she sees me, she goes like this, and she makes her cross. And everything's interpreted that, oh my gosh, she wants to die. No, she's happy to see me.
It goes back to perceptions, right? We all have our windows and our lens of how we see things. You're seeing it through your lens. She's seeing it through hers. The doctors and the nurses and the staff are seeing it through theirs. And it's the ability to communicate all of those different lenses and come to a common understanding of where do we go from here.
Well, this is the problem. We're always fighting to not have her disconnected. Because if any family member was to get together and sign, you know, to disconnect her, they will have to disconnect her. And I mean, that's not fair for her, because I see that she is a person, even though she's an elderly person, she's a very young spirit, she wants to live.
You're a person
so
to your...
So all of a sudden, it's like somebody can just sign you off, and they'll disconnect you. And I know it happens quite often in ICUs. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Other?
Thank you.
The difference between pressure and stress.
Sure, sure. Thank you for the question. Pressure, let me take an example. My son has recently done major high school exams. He came under a bit of pressure from his mother and myself because he's a fairly relaxed sort of guy. I think the pressure was conducive to him actually performing quite well, you know, because we didn't get to the point where the pressure exceeded his ability to cope. If we had, we'd have backed it off a little bit, you know. So pressure is where we feel pushed, where we feel engaged, we feel energized. Perhaps we've multiple demands on us, but we still feel that we're able to cope. we're still able to deal with that. And the sense we have of that is that it's fulfilling, it's charging, there's a bit, maybe a bit of an adrenaline rush, and we're coping, and that's fine. Now, if you contrast that to a situation where the demands on us are such that we now feel that we're not really able to cope, that there's too many demands, where we feel that an extra demand will really cause us to crash and burn, where we feel that we're making more mistakes, we don't have a sense that we've got control here, that's stress. So it's really looking at the balance between the two, how I see the demands on me and how I see my ability to cope. And if those two are balanced, that's fine. That's pressure. I can be challenged with it. But if it exceeds my ability to cope, then I'm in the stress arena. Okay? So if you take somebody, for example, who's learning a new task, our young doctors, for example, on call on a Saturday night, they have a case that comes in where it's difficult, or, you know, the consultant or the attending isn't around, and they're being challenged, you know, to put in a drain or something like that. That's very challenging. High demand, serious situation. Their sense of their ability to cope is quite low, so that's stressful. You take the same person a year later, and that's just pretty much routine, because now they've built up their capacity to cope with that situation. It's the same situation, but their perception of it has changed. And if you read the popular press, you very often see these terms, pressure and stress, confused. So a lot of people wander around thinking they're very stressed. In fact, they're busy, you know. And the final point I'd make on this, if you think about your job, there's two really important variables in your job. One is the variety and number of demands that your job makes on you. That's one part. But the second is how much control do you have? So you can be in a job where you've high levels of demands, multiple demands, but you've also got a high level of control. That's an active job. Those jobs are okay. The toxic jobs are the ones where the demands are very high in terms of variety and number of demands, and you feel you have very little control. Those jobs are high strain jobs. And there is evidence that those jobs do cause deleterious consequences for health. So it's really about the balance. If I feel I'm coping, and that's pressure. I might be pressurized, but if I feel I'm not, that's stress. Yeah.
Panel, want to comment at all on that?
I just wanted to say, with regards to caregivers that are taking care of people that are dying at home, we also then have to, as professionals, make sure that we assess what their level of balance between pressure and stress is in coping, because everyone copes with situations differently, and they may reach different breaking points at different points in the illness. So it's really important that people are able to express what their level of coping is, and that we can understand what it is and monitor their pressure, how the pressure is building up in them as well. And it goes back to your windows, your four windows. A lot of people are not aware of what their coping mechanisms are. They may not be aware of what's going to tip them over the edge. So it's also to help them learn a little bit about themselves before it actually happens.
I think the other thing is, as a caregiver, one of the biggest issues is that, you know, we have to view ourselves as partners with the medical profession and with the support teams, whether it be the CLSS or one other kind of community services available. And I think one of the things that at times that we forget is that as a caregiver, we're the advocate for our loved one. We act as that voice. And so we have to find a way of creating that partnership with people and having clear and honest communication so that we can establish a methodology to resolve issues, as opposed to constantly being, as the person talked about, being in an antagonistic situation.
I had just a final quick comment on that. A CEO of a large insurance company asked me some time ago to help them out, and we were talking about stress, and he said, "Karen, my job is to create stress around here." And I said, I sincerely hope not. I said, your job maybe is to create pressure. That's fair enough. And sometimes as managers or leaders, we create pressure. That's okay. If you're creating stress, you're essentially saying, I'm putting pressure on people that exceeds their ability to cope. And that's not what you should be doing.
Question in the front row.
Thank you. That was an extremely informative talk, but there's one area in particular that I wonder if you could just elaborate on a little, and that is the concept of compassion. burnout, basically, or compassion, you refer to it as basically becoming indifferent.
Yeah.
From the point of view of the caregiver, burnout, we have fairly good coping mechanisms for. What do we do for the other?
I spent at one time, and well, I worked a lot with post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, helping people who had been in very traumatic situations. And there's a constellation, many of you will know this, there's a constellation of symptoms that occurs in post-traumatic stress disorder. Clearly, one of those is that, you know, is re-experiencing. The mind keeps going back over the traumatic event. That's one. The second is problems with what's called hyper-arousal, that we have difficulty sleeping, you know, difficulty putting things out of our minds, you know, difficulty just keeping control of it. And then very commonly, irritability and anger and so on can be part of that constellation. What we used to do as psychologists at one time, which was the accepted thing to do, was to do these critical incident debriefings with people who had been traumatized. And you'll see here, for example, the experience of that in this part of the world when some major event happens or something like that. This team is flown in and they do all this stuff. Well, they did a major, what we call a meta-analysis a few years ago on that, where they pulled together all the research evidence and about critical incident debriefing. And basically they found not only should we not be doing it, but it made the situation worse for people. And the reason it made the situation worse is that people have their own coping strategies and will often have supports around them, friends and family and so on. And that's more important than flying in experts, you know. Compassion fatigue sometimes emerges like that, that the way people feel is exhausted, angry, possibly, traumatized by the suffering that a loved one is going through, and, you know, finds it difficult to sleep and difficult to cope. That's where support is so important, and I think that's where palliative care teams, home teams and so on have a really vital support function, because issues that can be very challenging and very difficult for a carer, you know, very often there's a straightforward solution, you know, titrating a dosage of a particular medication or something like that. And I think it's one of the great things about the palliative care approach that it builds in that kind of support.
I would also add not to isolate yourself. I think a lot of people have built-in supports, but sometimes they don't seek them out.
Yeah.
They don't share maybe with their colleagues if you're in a profession where you might experience compassion fatigue, or if you're in a caregiving situation in your own family, is to share the burden of that care with others. People are willing to help a lot of times, but they don't know what to do, and sometimes people don't know how to ask. So it's a matter of trying to match that as well, saying, you know, I really could use you to go to the grocery store for me tomorrow. As opposed to saying, well, I don't want to. So there's a lot of, it has to do with relationships and so on. So it's, I guess, one of the key things is not to isolate yourself and to seek out, if you can, find ways to seek out support from different people. Because, as you mentioned, there's different types of support, instrumental support, emotional support. And people can offer you different types, and it's finding the right person for the right type of support. I think that's one of the key things. And using the teams that you have available to you sometimes things come to us very, very easily because we've experienced them before with other family situations. So we can offer that to you as a way of support as well.
Could I just add one, and thank you for the question. Just add one further thing. I think sometimes it's very important for people to know that what they're feeling is normal.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, other people in such situations would feel the same thing. That I'm not feeling guilty about feeling angry or feeling depressed or feeling I don't want to be there on that day, or that, you know, that I'm losing sleep. That's they're normal. I'm not going crazy. It's normal reactions to abnormal situations. So, and that's one of the other great advantages of having the team, care teams or supports around, that I can, you know, I can judge or I can get some feedback that this is okay. This is normal. Yeah.
The other thing, as a caregiver, oftentimes you're learning as you go. You know, in my situation, I come from the business world. I don't have a medical degree. So I'm learning as quickly as my husband was becoming iller and interacting with the system. And so you're constantly in a situation where you have to change and reflect and I guess in some ways learn to be kind and compassionate to yourself and to accept that help that people are so willing to give, because that's what community really is all about. And that is what gives you that sense of community when you're going through the illness, but then post-illness when there is the death.
Yes, you're still alive. Could you repeat the question for us?
Yeah, thanks for the question. But I think the question is, you know, what do you do with the sort of the daily hassles, the everyday hassles of life? Somebody said, I think it was Emerson that said, it's not the big things that send a person to the grave, it's the shoelace that snaps with no time left. It's the urgency. A couple of things to say about that. There's a lot of research on what you talk about, hassles. Just the accumulation of small hassles that eventually you get more and more exhausted trying to deal with them. And there's a couple of things I would say about that. The first is that, you know, the things that we can control, we should control, and the things we can't, we change our approach to it. So it's a matter of reducing as many of the hassles as possible, and that might be down to planning, more forward planning, might be down to getting better organized, those kinds of things. And then some hassles we can't do anything about. So what we're left with is changing our response to those. So if we take traffic, for example, I know a lot of people, certainly in Ireland, Dublin, London, a lot of people have to spend quite a lot of time sitting in traffic. Now, there's two responses that you can have to that. One is that you can sit there and fume, and the temperature in the car goes up and the windows get misted up. Or you can take the same situation and change the significance of the situation so that by listening to music, for example, or audiobooks or something like that while it's stuck in traffic now becomes a positive. The meaning changes, so we change the meaning of it. So what I used to do, I don't have to commute much anymore, but I used to take that time to catch up on reading by using audiobooks. And I got to the point where, you know, there were times I wished the traffic would actually be a little bit worse because I needed to get to the end of a chapter. So it's an example of actually thinking smarter. It's about changing the way we deal with the situation when we can't change the situation itself. Another example of hassles for a lot of us is other people. You know, Sartre, the philosopher, said, hell is other people. You know, and with other people, I think, you know, there's a number of ways of dealing with this, but clearly you're not going to change the other person's personality. You know, the fact that they were weaned too young or something, you know, you're going to change that. So what do you have control over there? All you've got control over is yourself, your own reaction to the other person. So we don't work with people who get angry very easily, where we teach them, you know, breathing techniques, or they change the game. Basically, what they do is, what this person, I'm going to work out, what is it that makes me so angry about this person? Why do I find them reacting with anger in this situation? So I've changed the context now, I'm asking questions. Can I go 5 minutes with this person without getting angry next time? So I challenge myself in that way. And it changes the significance. Could I put myself in that person's position and see me as they would see me? It's the Johari window kind of thing. What is it? So we change that. But all we really have control over is our own reaction to the other person. And that's what we work on. We work on our own reaction. And it's amazingly effective. It's extraordinarily effective. You know, you get a much greater sense of control then in those kinds of circumstances. So that's an example of another one. Just taking Javi, if you look at that quadrant three, the quadrant one and three, all that urgent stuff is where an awful lot of the hassle is. And when you stop to think about it, how many of the things that you actually engage in that seem important are actually important at all? You know, would they matter if your circumstances changed? You know, what are the really important things? So thinking about quadrant two, the stuff that is important but not urgent, can really reduce the significance of all that urgent nonsense kind of stuff.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Percy Andersi. I don't think this is working, so...
Yep, Bill.
It will, okay. I'm an advocate for palliative care. I know Frida because I had taken a seminar, a workshop, at the Mount Sinai Hospital. I'm going to make a weird suggestion, and sometimes when discussed with various people, it may work out. I'm going to suggest that some sort of template be prepared. I don't know by whom, but using your volunteer corps, and there's going to be a session on Friday, and that maybe could be discussed, to bring self-care and self-management to prospective users of palliative care well before they enter into the system. How can it be done? Who shall it be done? Well, I can make one little suggestion. The Neuro has a new palliative care, Neuro Palliative Care Sector. It also sponsors something called My Toolbox, which is out of Stanford University, methods to manage your chronic problems. I'm suggesting that this be handled very lightly and simplified. I don't know who could simplify it. But I'm putting the problem out there because I think the patient should be involved more in their role for their self-care because they perceive themselves a lot better than their caregivers and their professional caregivers. You just proved it. I think that's enough for a start.
Thank you for bringing up the toolbox, because it is actually a wonderful resource that we have here in Montreal, and it's actually all over Canada and United States. It's a group support program for people that suffer from a chronic illness, and it helps them to learn how to live with a chronic illness. So I think it's a 10-week program, six. So it's run, you can actually look it up, I believe, on the web, mytoolbox.com, and they will let you know where you might find this group in the Montreal area.
But I'm saying to a client, the palliative care prospects, it's a weird thought. But, you know, sometimes weird thoughts.
Well, it's actually not that weird of a thought, because a lot of times now when people are diagnosed with, for instance, with cancer, it is now considered a chronic illness in a lot of cases. So early, what you're suggesting is early on, and perhaps in a diagnosis, that people learn how to live with their illness.
Yes, and who shall do it and how? And I think maybe some sort of project.
Professor O'Boyle, any thoughts?
Thank you.
I'm just thinking that through, because it reminds me of something that's happening in relation to patient safety. A lot of us are very concerned, and we teach a lot now in the medical schools, and a lot of systems being built into hospitals and other providers to try to improve the safety of healthcare. And one of the things we've suddenly realized in there is patients are a very important part of that, because patients actually are the continuous line down to the integrated healthcare system, but are rarely involved in actually improving safety, and that's pretty much the same as the same idea. You know, the patient is probably the expert, really the expert on their own condition.
Well, I
in these circumstances.
Bring it forward, but nobody knocked on my door.
Yeah. I think it's very interesting.
Yeah.
From a layman's point of view.
Yeah. Yeah.
One more or. At the most, two. Ma'am?
Hi. Hi, my name's Samantha. I'm a resident, actually, at Family Medicine Resident. And just coming from sort of my point of view, where do you have any advice in terms of, you know, we've had a few discussions here about from the other side, from family members, from the caregivers, all of that, and the clash between the medical profession and communication and all that. Do you have any advice as to how we can bridge that a little bit more, or, you know, from at what point do we start some of these discussions, especially maybe from a GP point of view, where we get to know the patients themselves better, not just for the patients who are terminally ill, but those who are having chronic diseases and whatnot. Where, any advice as to sort of where we can start getting into that, and where does experience come in? Talking about the DNR situation, you know, with, I don't like to get up on a patient and do chest compressions and break their ribs because I don't want the patient to come up from that or their families to see that. But I don't know that the families understand that so much. Any thoughts?
That sounds like one for you. I think it's a very interesting question. One of the problems that we have in medical education, I think, is that we have been very focused on the technological sort of aspects of education. And if you think about the complexity of what a doctor now has to negotiate in terms of complex biological systems, psychological, emotional, organizational systems, it's an extremely difficult trajectory that. One of the ways I tend to conceptualize this is that I think there are signs, if you take a biological perspective, there are signs which translate into symptoms. Sometimes some signs do, sometimes don't. The next layer up really is health status. So that's the functional. But if we get up to health status, we're now taking into account already more of a patient's perspective in making judgments. And then I think the next level up is quality of life. And there may well be a level above that, which is transcendental, which is the whole spiritual side of this. I think we've been pretty good at training for signs, symptoms, perhaps, and adverse effects. We haven't really been so good on helping young doctors to deal with health status or with quality of life. So I think that's one part of it. I think the second part of it is really the emerging importance of professionalism and professional development and building those into educational curricula right from the start so that, you know, our graduates then have those kinds of skills, the very skills you're talking about, but how to negotiate, about how to read effectively what's going on. And I think that's happening, certainly happening here at McGill. It's happening in lots of medical schools. You know, so I think broadening out the base on which those transactions can happen is what's necessary. But clearly it has to be done in such a way that we don't make things worse. We actually provide a platform that allows things to improve. But I detect a movement back to that, an increase in concern that high technology approaches in medicine have dehumanized medicine. I mean, a lot of people are talking about the New Yorker article by Gawande. That's a surgeon talking, you know, and that's very interesting. Maybe a surgeon, it's the surgeons are the ones who have to say those kinds of things. So I think the educational processes can certainly help with this. The real challenge, it seems to me, and this came up today, is that a lot of this really isn't about individual doctors and nurses and health professionals. A lot of it is about changing organizations, the way organizations are structured, the way they run, the way payments operate, the way HMOs operate. And I think that has to be a two-pronged approach. It's got to be about developing health professionals, but it's also really got to be looking at how things are structured and how they're organized. I know you know a lot about this.
One of the comments I would have is that while we learn a lot of what we're teaching at McGill from the palliative care sector, because that's where people actually get to be the doctors that we all wanted to be when we got into training, the other place we're taking a lot of our teaching and learning from is family practice, because of the beauty of the relationship between the physician and the patient. So I commend your choice of career and I really appreciate your question, but for me all of it comes back to technology or no about technology. I mean, I come from a research background where I lived in technology and fetal oxygen saturation for 5 years and escaped to McGill to learn about relationships in medicine. And everything that you describe and the challenge of the DNR and the resuscitation and the disturbing images and all those things that you worry about may not be of concern to this lady here who really wants the patient to be heard and have their wishes be respected by the profession. So for me, it comes back to relationship. How do we teach the medical students how to build that patient-physician relationship? Remember, without patients, there are no physicians. And really meeting the patient where they are. And one of the things I got from this morning was relationship is very close to expectation. Realistic expectation, unrealistic, mismanaged, mismatched, and relationship with a proper discussion, which I have with my family doctor, maybe not necessarily in the hospital, is what's important to you? What do you expect from this? How can I help you by telling you what you can change and what you can't change? And let's move forward together with something that's negotiated that we all understand.
And you may have noticed a certain similarity of accent. It's now my very pleasant job to thank Professor O'Boyle. My association with palliative care goes back a long time, and I have to think that of all of the things that have happened to me, particularly in later life, that have made me understand myself better, it's been that association. And this has been another very significant event in my journey to understanding myself. I think that the best of the guest speakers that come to talk to us, no matter what the sponsoring organization, their most useful contribution is to have us understand ourselves and what we're doing. It's also given me it's given me a new understanding that Dr. McNamara is going to appreciate, actually some optimism, because there's no question that our younger physicians, unlike my generation, are living more time in your upper right-hand box. And they're putting more of the big stones in first than we did. And in fact, we're trying to teach them to do that. So when I say you've helped me understand us, you've also helped me understand what we're trying to do. We are extraordinarily grateful. It was a wonderful, enlightening talk, and we all thank you. And everyone have a good evening.